Well, welcome to Tech Can Save Us. We're excited to have you on. Today we have Kajal Singrachka, founder and director of Growth Hub Global. Welcome, Kajal.
Thanks.
Quick background, we met on Lunch Club. So if we're talking about tech for good, maybe you could quickly share your experience on Lunch Club. How's it been?
Very interesting. I'm very skeptical of these types of platforms. Overall, I've had a very good experience, very varied group of people, including you, of course, and I think they facilitate it incredibly well. So definitely a great example of tech for good.
Good. All right. Well, we'll jump in. Let's chat. Let's talk tech for good. So first things first, let's start with what you do, who you are. So you wear a bunch of different hats. Give us a quick rundown of all of them to start out.
Yeah, I've had to try to perfect this into a nutshell. So let me say it's really three acts of my career so far. The first act was the well-trodden corporate career. So worked in London and Wall Street, but really learned the nuts and bolts of strategy and operation. But it was before the advent of, you know, some of the really powerful technologies you see today. The second act was, I need to do something different. I was always starting entrepreneurial initiatives in the corporate world. So I went back to business school in New York and really used that as a launch pad to start my entrepreneurial career. And it was a super exciting time in New York. It was really the nascency of the startup movement. It's all New York morphing from finance to being known as Silicon Alley. And that was 4 years of running my own company, but also co-founding Columbia University's first incubator. So really seeing what early stage startups go through from academia to then transitioning to their own startup. So I used that experience. I was a Brit expanding and growing a business in the US, and really used that learning, all the successes and failures and mistakes that go along that journey, to support founders from Europe who were looking to expand into the US market. And then fast forward to where we are now, my sort of love for universities and the academic world and really being able to translate that path from when you go from academic to starting your own company, I reconnected with my alma mater, LSE. And they were growing the entrepreneurial program. And after I'd grown Columbia's, the last 2 years have really focused on starting, designing and running the LSE's first ever accelerator. So,
and that's called the Generate Accelerator, right?
Yeah. So we launched that for the first time last year. And that was LSE only. And off the back of that, you know, on the topic for Tech for Good, we launched a impact accelerator across 8 universities. So very much amalgamating the tech and the tech for good, but business for good as well.
Right, right. So what have you learned, you know, from the, I'm assuming these are early stage startups in the accelerator? What have you learned from working across, you know, I guess dozens of early stage startups at this point in terms of tech for good and yeah?
So what we've learned, I'll give you my most recent experience. So these are 19 impact-driven companies. A proportion of them have a tech component, but they're really led with that purpose and that mission. And translating that into a tech product or into a business and a viable commercial entity. And what's so interesting is, you know, compared to a normal accelerator where you just have for-profit, for example, they're really led with that inspiration. And I feel like everything else can come off the back of that. You can learn how to do the product build and the tech and bring in the right people. You can learn how to do the business bit. But if you don't have that kind of inspiration and real purpose from the beginning, it's a different journey.
Can you give us an example of like what's a, you know, crystal clear purpose or inspiration that you saw from one of the founders that just really kicked off a great tech for good business?
Sure. There's two. There's one which is I Speak Mental Health. So they recognized during COVID the impact of that on students, and specifically as a group, you know, all the anxiety around your careers, etc. And they started making kits to support students with their mental health and gamifying it and thinking about digital platforms around this. And it was just a perfect example where they were experiencing it. They saw people around them experience it, and they started building an idea and proposition around this, and really cognizant of the fact that you can use tech and digital products to aid this. So that's one really strong example.
That's great. What were they called again?
They're called I Speak Mental Health. So it's a great team of two founders. So look them up.
Maybe we'll invite them on. That's a good look. And there was another example you said?
Yeah. So this is part of something called the Aspect Accelerator. So this is across 8 universities. There's another company called New Mind. And they want to promote independence after any brain condition, people who have had brain conditions or brain injury. And they realized, you know, there's a big market in rehabilitation here and wanting to give people that independence, autonomy, kind of dignity back into their lives. So they, you know, started building a product. They used secondary research, they used experts and their tech knowledge to combine those two things to build a product around this. So again, you know, if that works, that they've started with that inspiration and their own personal experience in this to build it into a product that could serve hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, that was sort of my next question. Are you finding that founders are building out of, you know, their family's experience, their own individual experience to find that passion and then building a product? Or how are they connecting with the mission, I guess?
So I would say it's across the board. It's not necessarily that they've had the experience, but I have to say it does make such a big difference, right? This is such a tough journey. You know, I know this. And when you've had that personal experience, you've felt it intimately. There's a different genetic code when you're starting that business and the DNA of that business. Of course, there's millions of successful businesses that don't have that. But there's something different about that emotion, that feeling when you speak to that founder and their drive, especially in those early stages.
Yeah, a bit of a teaser here, but I'm actually working on a tech product myself. And, you know, it kind of came out of the experiences last summer where, you know, all the protests were kicking off for Black Lives Matter. And, you know, I had a lot of friends who were hitting me up with the questions and, you know, trying to get my perspective on things. So I cheekily made this thing called, you know, oneblackfriend.com that was, you know, sort of like resources and like, hey, just go here. And, you know, like I'm getting a lot of phone calls and I'm now trying to turn that into, you know, a much less cheeky, but more helpful tech product that, you know, helps people learn and grow with their friends online. So more to come on that, but definitely connecting with that idea of, you know, that's in my like DNA and my personal experience. And I'm now trying to build on that to create something. So
what your experience is, how do you translate that personal experience into a tech product and a business? That's the kind of secret sauce I'm seeing with all these founders. And a study we're doing right now is, okay, you know, you managed to do this in a cheeky way, but actually that cheeky messaging could work really well.
But yeah, I wanted to pick your brain about, you know, you mentioned working across the, you know, entrepreneurial ecosystems in the US and then in Europe and the UK. What would you describe as the key differences and similarities between those systems?
So let me start with an anecdote, which I think will, you know, distill this into a fairly laser focused point. I was in an accelerator in New York, and it was an enterprise accelerator, and I heard these two founders, they just started a company out of MIT and they were working on like customer service and they were automating and making that more impactful. And they were having a discussion on when they were going to IPO their company. I would not hear that in a coffee room in an accelerator in London, very unlikely, or anywhere in Europe. At least I haven't so far. Okay. I don't want to, you know, generalize too much, but there is a capitalist or, you know, this genetic in the US, and maybe that's a function of our education systems, our social welfare, etc. But they just have that intrinsically in a way that many Europeans don't. I think that's starting to change, absolutely. And I think it can be a learned behavior. But, you know, I think the US is got a leg up there in terms of that mindset.
And just to clarify, are you seeing that as a strength or a weakness or both, or like how? Yeah.
So it can be a strength and a weakness. You have to tread quite carefully, right? If we're thinking about, you know, the subject of this podcast, Tech for Good, there's a lot of tech that could be easily flip over to Tech for Bad. It could start off as Tech for Good. Facebook.
Preach.
so there's a line. So overall, absolutely, it's a good thing. That's why we've got the companies that are born from the US, but I think it has gone too far.
Yeah. Definitely seeing the limits, as we've seen in the past 4 years, of American bravado and sort of just like, yeah, I mean, and it's interesting for me as like an expat living outside of the States to like negotiate that within myself. Like sometimes I'm like talking to people in Europe and the UK and I'm like, Paul, like chill out, like you're moving too fast, too hard, you know, and you can see people reacting to that in various ways. So
yeah, and I think, look, you embrace it, you know, don't let people knock you for it, because now that I've transitioned back, I see what an asset it is.
Yeah.
And I suppose the second, you know, to your question, the second point to make there is, one is that founder mindset and that willingness to take risk and accept failure. The second is that, you know, the ecosystem, you've got more people who've done that and been down that journey, and then that knowledge loop that you get just feeds that. It's a virtuous circle. Once again, you know, I do think Europe and is catching up, but the way that exists, you know, in clusters in the US, is it's a high bar.
Mm-hmm. When you're coaching and supporting startups in these accelerators here in the UK, like what are sort of the one or two key, I don't know, skills or maybe founder mindsets that you're coaching for that maybe are different from what you'd see in the US, you think?
Done is better than perfect. So, you know, don't keep waiting to perfect a product. This is always my beef with many founders, at least in continental Europe. But really get things out there, get that customer feedback, get those iterations, no matter how imperfect you think it is, but don't sit in a room and, you know, use secondary research or, you know, read papers and then build this thing for 9 months, which then nobody wants to buy. So right. It's really that getting out the room and customer validation.
How have you seen people, like, so getting into the cultural stuff, like the concept of, I don't know if this is like European or Australian, I heard it once, but like cut the tall poppy, right? Like don't stand out too much. Like don't, you know, we live in a collective society. Like, how have you, A, does that exist? Because I'm assuming it does. And then B, how have you seen, you know, European, UK founders get over that sort of cultural instinct to maybe tamp down and not stand out above the pack?
This could be a whole podcast on its own. but if you heard of something called the Gini coefficient?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So the measure of equality. So I'd gone on a trip from New York. I flew from New York to Helsinki. Yeah. Yeah. And these are polar opposites on the Gini coefficient. And I got to Finland, and the culture is, it's incredible in that it's a real collective. There's a real community build around it. The genetics of their, you know, their accelerators are all about the team and not about the individual. And you are frowned upon if you try to stand out. The flip side of that, I think, for entrepreneurship and for startups is, by definition, you have to, you know, to get something in the market, to do well, you've got to have that ability to stand out and, you know, do what's icky, which is self-promote a lot, ask a lot. And it's not incentivized or encouraged, especially in certain countries in Europe. So yeah, I think that has to be... You have to flip it on its head, which is, it's not about self-promotion. You, like you said, okay, your product, One Black Friend, that's going to offer value to the world. You shouldn't be afraid to be bold about the messaging and put that out there and, you know, reframe that. It's not about self-promotion and being the best amongst everybody else and competitive. It's about you having value and getting your product and message out there.
Yeah, more on that later. I don't want to take up... What's the most successful Tech for Good venture that you've had the opportunity to witness firsthand, and what do you think its special sauce was?
Oh, that's a really good question, which I... Is it called Mesa in Kenya? Mesa Pay, pooling money and allowing friends and family for the underbanked or people who can't bank. Yeah. I mean, it's essential, right? It's the only way you can really continue and live your livelihood. And I met... It was a guy actually hacking coconuts on the beach. I was in Mombasa, and he showed me this on his phone, and it was just incredible. You know, he doesn't have a lot of money, but he was able to transact. And I just thought to myself, if a guy on the beach hacking coconuts, you know, has a way, to run his business, to have his livelihood. That's game-changing tech for good to me, that financial inclusion.
That's the definition of the edge user, is like the guy on the beach hacking coconuts. That's really well said. You said it's called Mazer?
It's a really famous one. I really should remember the name, but it's Mazer. I think it's in Kenya. It's massively successful.
We'll look it up and try and get them on the pod. That's a good call. And yeah, we love TransferWise. We swear by it. I've actually done some of their content strategy in the past. So yeah, love them.
M-Pesa. Sorry, it was really annoying me, so I had to get that. It's called M-Pesa. It's been, you know, in the mobile payment space, it's been wildly successful.
Got it. Well, we'll invite them on. Get them talking about what they're doing. That'd be great. All right, so pivoting a bit here. We're going to go through some of the questions we ask all of our guests. So not quite rapid fire, but just sort of getting your perspective on all things here. First thing, we'd love to hear what kind of tech stack you work with, and sort of what's been a game-changing tech product in your work life.
So I definitely am an evangelist and romanticize the no-code movement. And the reason I say this is we were launching the accelerator in person 2 days before the whole world shut down with COVID. And we had about, you know, 2 weeks to pivot this whole thing to a virtual model. If I didn't have Slack, Notion, Airtable, this would have been fairly impossible to pull off. So that was game changing, and, you know, figuring out a way they can all work together. So I've used those three now in various different contexts, but for the accelerator, who we had the cohort all around the world in different countries, they flew home, and it made sure that we were able to just do things very, very quickly, and able to digitize that whole program because of those tools.
That's great. So sell me on Airtable over Google Sheets.
Airtable was brilliant, just in terms of organizing and, you know, for example, when people were pitching, sending in pitches, collating that and ranking, and it is quite powerful. I'd still divert back to Excel sometimes in Google Sheets. But, you know, they have different uses. And I think when you're building that tech stack, you find the ones that, you know, fit for each use and work together well. So that's the three that we ended up using.
I've gotten to a point with Slack where, like, if I'm connected with someone on Slack and they email me, I'm like personally resentful. I'm just like, why? Why have you? I shouldn't be that way, but I really am. I don't know. Yeah, I need to change my outlook, but I'll see. We had a client the other day that was like, yeah, we're on Teams. I was like, cool, we're on Slack. We'll wait for you there.
Yeah, it's interesting, all this tech snobbery. I do remember, if I didn't walk in with an Apple in the US when I was running my first business, I was automatically the frowned upon. So there's definitely a hierarchy. But I would say Notion is at the top of that stack.
Yeah, Notion's the one that I'm like dipping my toe in, and I'm like, I literally have like the subscription page up on my tabs here because I'm like ready to buy it and just go all in. So yeah, they're an interesting one. I don't know if I'd call them tech for good, but maybe. Would you consider Notion tech for good?
I would. I would in lots of different ways. The way they've built the company and how community driven it is, and just the power of it for project management and running teams. They may not have an outwardly facing, this is our mission, but what the power of what it can do, especially for smaller organizations which have budget constraints, I would put it in a tech for good. Yeah, it's democratizing, you know, traditionally very expensive software.
Yeah, I like that, because I mean, before we started recording, you asked me like, how do we define tech for good? And I like how you just like, I think, unfurled a way of defining it as like, you know, it can be your internal values, it can be the effect your product has on communities. Yeah, that's powerful. Way to answer your own question. Good job there. What's one problem that tech can't solve for us?
So this is something I've really discovered during COVID, being on Zoom and screens all day. You can't replace body language and sales, you know, face-to-face meetings and sales, especially in context of sales. There is so much that gets lost in translation on screen, either underplayed or overplayed or misinterpreted. I don't know how tech could ever read body language or someone's, you know, emotion. Yes, you have all this facial recognition technology, etc., but it just doesn't replace how you feel and how you interact when you're in front of another person. So I personally think this whole narrative of, you know, exodus from cities, we're not going back to the office, is very overplayed. You know, once one person in the team goes back every day, you're not going to replace that interaction with something on a screen.
Yeah, I question those narratives as well, because whenever I hear those narratives, I keep going back to the idea of power, and I'm like, who is pitching this narrative? Like, who does this benefit for people to leave cities? You know, and I don't mean to sound conspiratorial, but like, it just feels very aggressive and not grounded in reality.
Estate agents in the country.
Exactly. I mean, it's, yeah, and I'm the child of an estate agent, so I'm I know what's up. Like, I know how they roll. Cool. And what was the other thing that you mentioned that you made me think about? Oh yeah, I also agree, like the human connection piece. Like, I'm a music head. Like, I love going to live music and concerts and things like that. And I've never wanted to just like be jostled with a bunch of sweaty strangers before more in my life. And it used to annoy me, but now I'm like, I want that, you know, I want that human connection with strangers. Like, and you can't get that in a live stream, you know, so.
No, that's an interesting one to create, because you always ask people, what's the first thing you want to do after lockdown? You're the first person who's said that answer, so.
What's yours? What's the first thing you're going to do?
I honestly, it's very simple, but dinner with friends, in a nice restaurant. I really just miss that, having that conversation. And, you know, once again, even in the context of all my work with founders and building things, the best insights come from those conversations, you know, when you're just in a pub or you're having dinner. That's where all my best insights and most of the founders I know, their best insights come from. And even outside of a professional context, you know, on a personal level, you can't get to know someone the same way. So that's my first one. I have a restaurant pick around that, but.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, we talked a lot about restaurant. What's your restaurant pick?
Exactly. It's the Hoppers, South Indian. So there's one in Soho. So that's my first one.
Got it. Add it to my list. Yeah, and the thing I think about with that too is just the lack of variety in our lives right now. Like we're working all the time, and the way that, like, you know, those outlets like dinner with your friends or going to see music feeds back virtuously into your work. I think that's the piece that I'm missing the most. Like, just having that feedback loop of, oh, I got this creative idea when I was out taking a walk with a friend or at dinner, or, you know, from this music I was listening to, and applying it to your work and the rest of your life. Like, that's a big missing piece for me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, your question was what one problem tech can't solve for, but it's also what can tech not replace?
Exactly.
You cannot replace a walk. And I've found this now, being every day on screens for nearly a year. It just, it's not working. I think we're all feeling that now. It's not working. Yeah. And then you get bombarded with a new tech product that you can use for this X, Y, and Z. And I actually always challenge my founders on, why is tech the solution for this? Tech the solution for this? And I think we have to keep asking ourselves this question.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I mean, yeah, so much that, again, that could be another podcast, but yeah, that's, why is tech the solution for this? I think is a core tech for good question, you know, and like principle almost, like exactly. The principle being tech can't solve everything. It shouldn't. Is there like a low tech human way to solve this, you know, and answering that. So that's great. Tech for bad. I know you want to talk about it. What's the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
Instagram. So I watched The Social Dilemma recently, and you know, I was getting more concerned about, and I consider myself to have fairly strong willpower and, you know, not lots of addictions, and I am addicted to my smartphone. And I watched this program and I just thought, that class, Persuasive Technologies, they had at Stanford, that's the most effective means of translating human behavior, you know, social science, into a product. And, you know, I think to the point of mass manipulation. I mean, we are a product of what we ingest and what we read and what we see, right? So it's manipulated our brains in such a way You know, and again, another anecdote, I used to remember phone numbers. I don't know anyone's phone number now, right? That's a dumbing down of my brain from using a smartphone. So I really don't like the idea of that kind of manipulation that I feel now on a daily basis. And I have to have more and more willpower to guard myself against this. And I don't think the tech companies are doing enough. Yeah. And so one of the things I'm working on now, I'm specifically interested in social science commercialization. We're doing a study on more tech for good. How do you translate and combine, you know, social science, human behavior with tech for good, for impact-driven businesses? You have to have both. Like, if you think about AI, you need that ethics part to AI. You can't just let AI grow without some kind of code in there on ethics. So how do you combine tech with social science to make sure that's a powerful combination for good? We had a demo day actually with Imperial, so between the LSE and Imperial, and you could see the force of those two things coming together as a great combination. But if you just had the tech, or you just have, you know, the for-profit business, or you just had just the social that doesn't earn any money, right? Those things don't work in silos. I think this tech for bad can be somewhat ameliorated if you had that influence, if you had, you know, that social science influence or ethics influence in a good way. But yeah.
That's really interesting. I mean, I want to dig into that research at some point. So please, like, send me whatever you have, and I'd love to, you know, write about it, synthesize, work with you on it. That'd be amazing. And yeah, I think we're like moving into this really interesting era where, you know, there's that famous quip of like, the greatest minds of our generation, millennials at least, have been used to like sell people ads, right? And that's the social dilemma. And like, that is like deeply dispiriting that like, if that's true, and now you see, you know, I think some millennials and definitely Gen Zers sort of catching wind of this and being like, man, like, we really need to infuse all tech with these human principles and ex parte, as you said. And there's just a shift now because people are realizing that we went down one lane and it was really bad. It was just for capitalism and sales and ads. And now we need to pivot. So,
I mean, I hope so. I hope we haven't gone too far down one road. I mean, it's an incredibly successful business model, right? And concept, but absolutely it's, but when I see the kind of digital natives, millennial Gen Z, I do feel dispirited and sad because I think they're productizing themselves, you know, to be influencers, and you're not living your life. You're becoming this product on Instagram.
So the joke about the what's the evilest application of tech question is, at least on this podcast, is the answer is always Facebook. And so you nailed it. In this case, Instagram, product of Facebook. And I should be careful because I have a friend who I'm trying to get on from Facebook on the podcast. So we'll see how that works out. Yeah, I look at my generation. I consider myself an old millennial, and it makes me sad, you know. And where I was really going was, I left Facebook as a user in, I guess it was 2017, and I'm still not back on. And I'll never forget the messages I got from friends, and like friends loosely, like people I rarely talk to, you know, Susan I went to college with, who now has a baby and lives in Iowa. Like, they just felt entitled to be a part of my life at a distance. And they were like, people were like angry with me and upset with me. Like, why'd you leave? Like, how am I going to know what you're doing? And it's like, mate, we never talk, you know? And like that, just seeing that was like, wow. Like, it was a real gut check.
Yeah. And I'm not on Facebook. I mean, I'm on there just at my account's active, but I read this quote recently, which said, if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. You've obviously come across it, but that really just hit me. You know, I don't want to be your pawn in your advertising sales model. I just don't want to trade my data. And this recent WhatsApp, you know, privacy, I've gone to Signal and I will slowly get off WhatsApp. And I think the more we do that as consumers, the more we stand up, the more we're sending that message. And that's certainly why I think, you know, things like the circular economy is driven by the consumer saying, look, we don't want fast fashion. We don't want these throwaway things. And once the consumer starts speaking, the business world starts to change and the capital world starts to change. But our actions on, okay, not using Facebook, that counts. You know, your individual actions saying no to this counts.
I think there's something to be said for intentionality too. And like, I was listening to another podcast the other day, and they were talking about how, you know, these platforms didn't start with purpose, you know, as you mentioned earlier, with founders who were like, I want to solve this problem for the world. Like, Facebook was a platform to rate how hot people were on college campuses, you know? And it's like, it is a purpose. I don't know if it is an entirely virtuous one, and not all, you know, tech products need to be entirely virtuous, but the fact that it's like now turned into this thing that is causing insurrections in capitals around the world, you know, like, I don't know. It's just, I don't know. It's there's something to be said for starting a thing with intentionality and purpose around helping people and not rating how hot they are or trying to get them to buy things, you know? So I don't know.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, there's a big question here on, you know, I asked you, you know, what's the definition of tech for good? Now, I use a lot of fitness apps. So My Fitness Pal, and, you know, I wonder what your opinion is on that, because I've also heard that can go too far on calorie counting. It's sort of, is there just something that's more of a, for us as humans, to just guard ourselves? You know, any tech product we're sold, we've got to have that extra layer and that extra filter and that extra independent level of thinking to guard ourselves from the negative outcomes of using these.
I think what that podcast I was talking about the other day was saying was that, like, you know, a lot of these applications have been started with the intention of making it addictive for you. And then, if at all, purpose has been grafted onto it. Or at least that's what we need to do now, is we need to graft purpose onto this thing that's been built, this Frankenstein, to rate how hot people are or, you know, whatever. And I think it's also about design principles, too. I was just reading an article the other day that was like, put in a timer that shows people how much they're consuming, you know, how much, like, I put that on my phone. I put downtime on my phone and it reminds me every 15 minutes, hey mate, you've been on here a lot on Instagram, like, take it easy. Like, design that into the tech. People are still going to use it. I blow past that limit all the time, but, like, you know, think about the humans.
But this is where I think the real secret sauce is, you know, for you and I and other people who are part of this movement or educating. So the study I mentioned I'm working on is around social business model innovation. So how do you imprint at the grassroots, instead of thinking of a traditional P&L, what's your impact metric and how are you going to design operationally, technically, around that principle? So when it's in the grassroots, it shouldn't be, doing it as an afterthought is very, very challenging. And you've gone too far one way. So we really are trying to build a framework for early stage founders to build that in right from the start and be thinking of that right from the start, and not to neglect that side of it. Because I just don't think in, you know, the next 10 years, you're not going to have an option. You have to build businesses that way.
100%. I mean, I was reading something the other day about how oil and gas companies, like, their P&Ls are bullshit because they're not factoring in environmental degradation, you know what I mean, in the broadest sense. And so when we talk about carbon taxes and some of these other, you know, functions that government's moving towards now to truly account for these industries, I mean, and the industries that get it are moving in the direction you're saying. They're building it in, you know, at least moving forward, so...
But the incentive for that, right, is like we just said, we're as consumers, okay, we'll leave WhatsApp, we'll leave Facebook. And now it's like the capital providers are asking for ESG metrics. Until you get the real decision makers, the drivers of that business, which does impact the bottom line, making a stand, I still think it's hard for things to change otherwise. So
that's a whole other conversation about, maybe we'll have you on again, about the ESG metrics and capital providers. That's so interesting to me. So gonna take us out here, a little bit of a lightning round. Three more questions. If you could dream up a new tech product, what would it be and what problem would it solve and for whom?
So yeah, I did think about this, and it's actually, you know, in my context of really wanting to serve entrepreneurs and people who are really going to drive this overall movement, I want their time to be spent on the most impactful things. And this is why I, you know, if we could, and this is maybe already built, but, you know, I think about starting a company. If I had a tool that can just figure out how to automate all those bits that I shouldn't be doing, you know, and string that all together, you know, we had to work out how to do this in several different contexts, but there's probably something out there that ties, you know, across sales, finance, HR, operations, legal, and you tie it all together, sort of an out the box thing, so that I want 75% of those founders' time to be on that mission and on the sales and driving the business forward. I want to automate out everything that they shouldn't be doing. You know, it could be reconciling a MailChimp distribution list. Those low value add things. But just that, if I take it even out of the microcosm of founders, the overarching concept is let's use our brains and creativity to make the most impact. And we need to, you know, the way the world is in. So how can we use tech, the power of no code, of, you know, cloud, and tie that all together so that our brains and our creativity can be fully tapped into?
Yeah, that's a good one. That sounds like a killer app. Quick thought, check out MyNexus. We're having James on later this week from MyNexus. They're basically trying to build like a better ecosystem for founders. So making it easier for them to match with investors. So kind of trying to automate and take a little bit of that off their plate might be interesting based on what you just said there. Last two questions. What's your big prediction about the tech for good space for 2021 and beyond?
Well, once again, because it's such a broad definition, I guess I'll focus in again on financial inclusion. You know, what we're seeing with the crypto market, the general state of our economies, I think fintech and the amount of impact you can have there, whether it's financial inclusion or whether it's, you know, democratizing access to capital in whatever form that comes, I think technology driving that is going to be one of the big winners. You know, I'm predicting hyperinflation and, you know, sort of our traditional monetary mechanisms really not working like we've been used to it. So I think, you know, the Monzos and TransferWises of the world was kind of a first gate. Then you've got all this crypto, which I think, you know, a couple of years ago when I was working in the space, it was still very, very early. People didn't understand this. I think now you're kind of starting to see, and not just because of the values, but you're starting to see the power of that decentralized network. Yeah, I would say the fintech world definitely is one that's going to be really thriving and innovative in the next 10 years.
Well, keep an eye on it. I have a friend who's deep into the crypto stuff and is always posting things. I'm like, mate, we got to sit down and just talk for an hour and I'll download your brain. So last question. So on the topic of defining tech for good, one of the principles that we're sort of landing on is balancing, you know, building a career and a life that balances profit and purpose. So not quite advice, but sort of what's worked well for you in terms of balancing profit and purpose in your career?
I think it really is a value. It's an overarching values driven principle. You know, you've got to keep the lights on, pay your bills, but you can always combine that with doing things that you love. And maybe ultimately that those two can collide. But I think it's really setting your values. You have a limited time on earth. And so I really question before I do each project, you know, how much am I motivated by this? How much do I think I can make an impact with my strengths and what, you know, that project needs or that client needs? And really being thoughtful about not just doing it for one reason or one dimensional reason. And so the same way I talked about, I think early stage founders can build in those design principles to their business or the tech. I think you can build in those design principles to your life. And say, you know, is this fulfilling those three criteria? And there's some stages, you know, you'll not be able to do everything in one go, but you can definitely balance it.
Yeah. And just design. I like the idea of designing your life. That's very like empowering. And I think gives people credit to kind of, you know, take the mantle, take the reins. That's great. Well, this has been a great conversation. I'm so grateful to have you on. We've been talking to Kajal Singracha, the founder and director of Growth Hub Global. And just really grateful for your time, Kajal. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Have a good one.